This is a talk from BeThinking.org, which is UCCF's apologetic website. Apologetics is basically two things. It's the communication and the defence of the Christian gospel. So visit BeThinking.org soon, and make sure you sign up as a BeThinker to hear all about BeThinking.org's latest releases. I feel light
in your arms. We come tonight to the third lecture in the series that we've entitled An Islam Primer. And in this tonight's lecture, I wish to continue on looking at what I've described as the most central beliefs and practices of Muslims worldwide. Now, by way of a lecture on the Holy Quran, and a lecture on the Holy Prophet Muhammad, we come tonight to those beliefs and practices known as the pillars of Islam. With virtually every treatment or summary of Islamic belief and practice beginning with the notion of the five pillars, it will probably come as no surprise to you tonight that this is where we will in fact focus our attention. However, what many non-Muslims overlook is the reality that the five pillars of faith have a larger context and a particular place within Islam. So to avoid this mistake and to give each of us here a more complex or more complete picture, my lecture tonight will proceed as follows. First, I want to step back and say a brief word about belief and practice as the means of salvation within Islam. As any devout Muslim will point out, the relation of faith and deeds must be constantly borne in mind in order to truly understand Islam and in order to enter into paradise. Second, I want to take a little time to simply articulate the pillars of faith. Now, for the sake of accuracy, it needs to be stated that the pillars of faith are six articles of faith, or six doctrines, which are distinguished from the more familiar pillars of Islam. And then, third, I want to note and discuss the pillars of Islam, those five ritualistic actions based on the beliefs that characterize a Muslim's devotion and which serve as the foundations of a Muslim's faith. So that's where we're going to go over the course of the next 45 or so minutes. So we'll begin first of all then with belief and practice as the means of salvation. As Muslim scholars note, the religion of Islam can be broadly divided into two parts. The first we can distinguish or designate as being theoretical, for in mind here are its articles of faith or its doctrines. The second we can refer to as being practical, as it includes all that a Muslim is required to do, that is to say, the practical course to which a Muslim must conform his or her life. In the Quran, these two broad divisions are repeatedly referred to as iman, meaning faith or belief, and amal, meaning deed or action. Often these words are used together to describe a believer. So, for example, a common Quranic phrase is this, those who believe and do good. This is a description of a true Muslim, one who will enter into paradise. Now, as we prepare ourselves tonight to consider both the pillars of faith and the pillars of Islam, what we need to keep in mind is the fact that within Islam, it is the intertwining of belief and faith that functions as the means of salvation. Muslim theologian Muhammad Abdul Qasim explains this succinctly for us. He says, "The Quran teaches that the means to salvation in the hereafter on the human side are belief or faith, iman, and action, amal. Salvation cannot be achieved without these two means." Muslim author and apologist Badru Kadarega also makes the point plainly. Belief alone is not enough, he says. Man must practically perform all the duties required by the Islamic faith. Now, I'm taking the time to point this out because of how often I read and hear and have had people raise with me the matter of the essential similarity between Islam and Christianity. Even within recent days, I've heard quite a bit of talk about how similar Islam and Christianity really are, about how similar what Muslims believe and what Christians believe really appear to be. And I've long heard people speak of the piety of Muslim practice and how their praying, fasting, and almsgiving, etc., must surely be pleasing to the God of the Bible. After all, it's argued, Jesus himself practiced these same kinds of things, and he enjoined them on his followers. Now, without in any way questioning, much less impugning the personal piety or devotional sincerity of Muslims, yet I believe that people who think in terms of essential similarity or of what actions are pleasing to God are actually forgetting the fundamental orientation or salvific framework of both Islam and Christianity. Yes, both religions and worldviews do have a rather dynamic nexus between faith and deeds. But fundamentally, they have a very different conception of them as means of salvation. For whereas the triune God of the Bible bestows salvation freely, as an act of grace received through faith alone, Allah is said to bestow salvation only when properly merited, that is, by the proper maintenance of faith and deeds. So as we come to the pillars of faith, and particularly to the pillars of Islam, we need to view them as essential requirements for salvation. Unlike Christianity, in which a person is saved ultimately neither by right doctrine nor by ritualistic practice, but by the grace of God laid a hold of with the empty hands of faith, Islam is a religion of duty and submission in which human effort leads to salvation. Now please understand, to set the pillars in this context is neither to disparage Islam nor to criticize it. Rather, it is simply to acknowledge Islam's own claims and to give due weight to Islam's own framework for belief and practice. As the Muslim author Mahmoud Ahyub explains for us, in Islam, there is no view of redemption as such. Adam is the first sinner, but also the first prophet. He missed the mark by disobeying the divine command, and he asked God's forgiveness. Every human is born like Adam, capable of knowing God and having pure faith. There is no original sin in Islam, only original purity. What this means, of course, is that we, like Adam, have the capacity, the very real ability, to put ourselves right with God. In contrast to Christianity, Islam teaches that a person can rehabilitate him or herself and can stand before God through submission and the five pillars. Therefore, in a very real sense, Islam teaches that heaven can be earned by the good deeds of the believer, as long as he or she is careful to fulfill the religious obligation and to make up any shortcomings by performing other favourable duties. This is the testimony of the Quran, it is the testimony of Muhammad the Prophet, and it is the testimony of Muslim theologians throughout history. Now, although a great deal more could be said at this juncture and on this topic, yet I think we are now in a position to move on to discuss the pillars of faith, those fundamental beliefs that a Muslim holds and must hold as a part of his or her submission to God. So we come now to the pillars, the fundamental beliefs of faith. As respected Islamic scholar John Esposito notes in his excellent introduction to Islam, this book here, Islam, the Straight Path, now in its third edition, it's an excellent resource for those interested. As John Esposito notes for us, the Quran established a set of basic beliefs that are the foundation of its worldview and the criterion for belief versus unbelief. Belief in God
and his prophet, previous prophets and revealed scripture, angels and the day of judgment. Acceptance of these beliefs renders one a believer of mu'min, while to reject them is to be an unbeliever, a kafir. This summary, based on the Quran, Surah 4, verse 136, articulates for us the fundamental beliefs that Muslims hold. Even though each of these beliefs is of interest and easily merits an entire lecture themselves, yet what I want to do on this occasion is simply to offer a basic summary of these five fundamental beliefs. I want to make known simply the most salient points pertaining to each of these areas. Now, as the majority of these points have been touched on in previous two lectures, I really will make this rather short and to the point. In order then, the six articles of faith are these. Number one, belief in the unity of the divine being. The first and most important doctrine in the creed of Islam is the existence and nature of Allah. Now, as I intend to give over a whole lecture to Allah in the next lecture of this series, let me here just summarize a few things. First of all, the essence or being of Allah includes his existence, eternity, unsubstantiality, unembodiedness, essentiality, omnipresence, formlessness, and uniqueness. These things belong to Allah's essence, his being. Allah's attributes include life, power, knowledge, will, sensibility, and speech, while Allah's works are his creation, preservation, revelation, and predestination. Almost always, however, the focus of the Quran and of Islamic thought in relation to Allah falls on his absolute unity. Again and again, the unity of the divine being is the point on which the greatest stress in Islam is laid. As an example of the strength of this emphasis, we can note the words of Surah 112, an early surah in which the doctrine of divine unity finds its clearest expression. The Quran, Surah 112, says, "In the name of Allah, most gracious, most merciful, say, He is Allah, the one and only, Allah, the eternal, absolute. He begets not, nor is he begotten, and there is none like unto him." As Muslim scholar and the Quranic commentator Maulana Muhammad Ali explains, these four short sentences negate the four kinds of polytheism that prevailed in the world before Islam: a belief in the plurality of gods or the plurality of persons in the Godhead, a belief that other things possess the perfect attributes of the divine being, a belief that anyone may be specially related to him as son or father, and a belief that others may do what is ascribable only to the divine being. From this scrupulously qualified explanation of the unity of the divine being, and from the fact that the only unpardonable sin in Islam is shirk, that is, attributing or associating other gods to Allah, one gains a sense of the uncompromising form of monotheism that Islam endeavours to maintain. Islam holds an absolute unity in God. There is no sense, no shade, no shadow of Allah being anything other than one, an absolute single unity. This brings us second to the belief in angels. A belief in angels is also among the most basic tenets of Islam. And this, it seems, because of Allah's employment of angels in connection with the revelation of his will, both to Muhammad and to the various other prophets before him, and also because of their connection with the awakening of spiritual development within man. The Muslim belief in angels includes a belief in all kinds of creatures inhabiting the invisible world. For example, Muslims believe in four archangels. There is Jibreel, or as we know him, Gabriel, the angel of revelation whose role it has been to deliver Allah's message to his messengers. There is Mikael, or Michael, the angel of providence, who is said to control the forces of nature and the allotment of nourishment. There is Israfil, the angel of doom, so called because he will sound the final trumpet. And finally, Azrael, known as the angel of death, and whose task it is to visit each person whose time is at hand so as to take their soul. Other angels include guardian angels, two of which are assigned to every individual. There are ministering angels, which move between heaven and earth, bringing blessings to the believers below on earth and bringing to heaven news of the good deeds and pious acts of the believers. Another group or category is the jinn, a group of spirits midway between men and angels, the chief of which is Iblis, the devil or Satan. They were able to acknowledge and accept positive values, yet typically the jinn are evil spirits or beings that invite mankind to do evil, while Iblis is always the enemy of human beings. So angels, then, the supernatural realm, has a significant place and role within the theology of Islam. This brings us thirdly to belief in the holy books of God, or the concept of revelation. Traditionally, Islam has a very robust doctrine of revelation. Contrary to what many have suggested, revelation is not limited to the prophets of Allah, but is also granted to other pious individuals, either through inner revelation or via dreams, visions, and trances. However, the highest kind of revelation, that kind of revelation which is peculiar to the prophets, is revelation recited in words. Muslims hold that it was in this manner that revelation was granted to all the prophets of Allah, and that the revealed books are a record of this highest revelation. Although Muslims are required to believe in the sacred books of every religion and nation, four sets of scriptures are particularly acknowledged as containing revelation of the will of Allah. These are Torah, the Torah of Moses, Zabur, that is, the Psalms of David, Injil, that is, the Evangel or Gospel of Jesus, and of course, the Quran, delivered by the Prophet Muhammad. As the final and complete revelation, the Quran supersedes all previous revelations and conflicting truth claims. Indeed, as Muslims believe that all previous sacred books, though given by Allah, yet have been altered and corrupted by human hands, the Quran alone speaks with real and binding authority. The Quran both perfects and functions as the guardian and judge over all previous revelation. The next article of faith follows right on from this. It's belief in prophets, the messengers of Allah. Regarding prophets, Muslims are duty-bound to believe that Allah has sent numerous prophets to all the nations of the world to function as guides, to function as warners or leaders of the way. Sometimes the number of prophets is given as 124,000. Sometimes it's as much as 144,000. But in the Quran itself, less than 30 prophets are named, the majority of which are biblical prophets. We can take as an example of this the sixth surah, verses 83 to 87, which give a list of some of these prophets: Isaac, Jacob, Noah, David, Solomon, Job, Joseph, Moses, Zechariah, John, Jesus, Elijah, Elisha, Jonah, and so on. The majority of these prophets are what we would call biblical prophets, prophets known to us in the Old and New Testaments of the Judeo-Christian scripture. 28 of these prophets are named in the Quran, and then there are several other prophets that we don't know of in biblical revelation. Interestingly, although the Quran records the sins of the prophets and their repentance, with the exception of Jesus, which I find interesting, yet generally Muslims believe that all of God's prophets were in fact sinless. As the Muslim scholar Maulana Muhammad Ali expresses it, the men who are commissioned for the high office of prophethood must themselves be free from the bondage of sin, and more than that, be possessors of high morals if they are to fulfill the mission entrusted to them. The doctrine of the sinlessness of prophets has therefore always been an admitted principle among Muslims. Although five prophetic predecessors to Muhammad seem to attract a fair degree of prominence in the Quran, these are Adam, Noah, Abraham, Moses, and Jesus, yet no other prophet is as exalted as is the prophet Muhammad. As the seal of the prophets, the last and greatest of the prophets, it is held that Muhammad was prepared for and attested to by all of the preceding prophets. In this light, Muslims consider Islam not as the youngest, but as the oldest monotheistic religion in the world. Just as an aside, one of the ways in which the prophet Muhammad is attested to or prophesied about, Muslims go to the New Testament and read John chapters 14 through 16, where Jesus talks about the Parakletos, the Comforter, the Advocate. And Muslims believe that that is a prophecy of Muhammad. And so there's an example of how previous revelations are used as attesting to the coming of Muhammad. Many Muslims read our own New Testament as referring and pointing beyond Jesus to Muhammad. We come then, fifthly, to the belief in a future life. Faith in life after death, including the resurrection of the dead, the day of final judgment, and the eternal hereafter, is incumbent on all Muslims and is considered vitally important. Practically, this belief is held to be both the greatest impetus toward good and noble deeds and the greatest restraint upon evil and irresponsible deeds. And on this account, appears as a common theme of exhortation in Islamic preaching. This was certainly true in Muhammad's day, and it continues to be true in preaching in mosques around the world today. Regarding the future life, Muslims believe that at a time known only to Allah, the angel Israfil will sound a trumpet that will result in a great cosmic upheaval and the subsequent death of all living things in heaven and earth. Israfil will then sound the trumpet a second time, resulting in the resurrection of the dead to life, so that all men and jinn can face their judgment. At the day of judgment, all actions will be weighed by God's power on enormous scales. It is said that a book of a person's actions will be placed in Allah's hands. His right hand, if the individual is pious and without sin, his left hand, if the individual is a sinner, and from the effects of the deeds done will a person be judged. Also, the bridge Sirat must be crossed. This bridge is said to be thinner than a hair and sharper than a sword, and while the true believer crosses over to paradise with ease, yet the infidel's feet slide so that they fall into hell. Once the true believers have entered into paradise, known as Jannah, which literally means a garden or a walled enclosed area, there they will dwell forever by flowing streams, reclining on silken couches, praising Allah and enjoying heavenly delights. In contrast to this, unbelievers will suffer and swelter in the hot blasts and foul smoke of hell. While some Muslims interpret such descriptions of the future life and its complex of events symbolically or metaphorically, yet it seems the majority of Muslims take them most literally. The sixth belief, belief in divine preordainment or predestination, is not mandatory in the same way as the other five, but it is still accepted by many Muslims and is frequently discussed in connection with the pillars of faith. The basic idea is that of acknowledging and obediently submitting to the reality that everything that happens, whether for good or for bad, can only happen by and with the knowledge and power of Allah. It is true that some Muslims believe in a very strict or uncompromising form of divine predestination, but overall, Islamic thought, particularly when based on the Quran, does seem to leave room for human freedom and self-determination. In connection with what I stated earlier about belief and practice, these articles of faith must be understood as not being optional. Rather, each of the pillars of faith must be held and adhered to by Muslims as a part of their submission to Allah. Moreover, and ideally, each of these articles of faith will be adopted as principles of action, shaping and governing one's day-to-day life. This brings us thirdly then to the five pillars, the foundational practices of Islam. So as we come then thirdly to the pillars of Islam, I think it's worth pointing out the obvious, namely that despite all the diversity and variation that marks Islamic practice and faith worldwide, still the pillars of faith, or the pillars of Islam, remain the core and common denominator. These five essential and obligatory practices are accepted and must be followed by all Muslims. What may not be so obvious, and yet what needs to be kept in mind, is the fact that these five pillars represent the minimum religious obligations and are only one part of a much larger and far more comprehensive religious ethical reality. And so the first pillar of Islam is this, the Shahada, the profession of faith. By definition, a Muslim is one who proclaims La ilaha illallah wa inna Muhammad Rasul Allah. That is, there is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his messenger or his prophet. This deceptively simple affirmation is actually a very nuanced summary of the heart of Islamic faith. For example, in the first half of the question of the profession, there is no God but Allah, Muslims acknowledge the unity, uniqueness, and transcendence of God. Moreover, this profession calls Muslims to watch vigilantly over their actions and their thoughts and their spiritual loyalties, lest they stumble or stray into subtle forms of idolatry to which human beings are susceptible. And so once again, Islam's absolute monotheism, its unshakable and uncompromising faith in the oneness or unity of Allah, is here affirmed. The second half of the profession, and Muhammad is the messenger of Allah, summarizes what Muslims believe about the human need for guidance and about how Allah has provided this guidance through his prophets, especially, of course, through Muhammad, the last and final prophet who serves as the great model and example for the Muslim community. Uttering the Shahada publicly, that is, before witnesses, with an understanding of its truth and with heartfelt sincerity, is really all that is required for full conversion to Islam. Of course, as the bedrock of Muslim faith and the foundation of the other pillars that will follow, Muslims continue to make this profession every single day of their lives. This brings us to Salat, the ritual prayer. The second pillar of Islam is the observance of five brief but regular prayer times that punctuate the day. Generally recognized as the first and foremost duty of a Muslim, prayer is a means of ensuring admission to the realm of everlasting happiness. Not only must prayers be performed by every Muslim man and woman of mature age and sound mind, but it must be performed correctly. Islamic scholar Anne-Marie Schimmel describes a part of what is involved. I'm going to quote at length from this book, Islam, an Introduction by Anne-Marie Schimmel. It's a tiny little thing, but a very, very capable introduction to Islam. Anne-Marie Schimmel then describes what it means to pray correctly or acceptably. The Salat, the ritual prayer, is performed 5 times in 24 hours. The hour before sunrise, noon, afternoon, after sunset, and nightfall. Every prayer begins with the niyyah, the formulation of the intention, for instance, to perform. The evening prayer with its 3 cycles or rak'ahs, rak'ah just means a repetition. During 1 rak'ah, the praying person stands upright, uttering the words, Allahu Akbar, God is greater than anything else, and the Fatiha, the opening surah of the Qur'an. And then one bends from the hips, straightens one's posture, prostrates, sits, and then performs another prostration. In the first 2 rak'ah or cycles, another chapter or some verses of the Qur'an are also recited. Each prayer consists of a prescribed number of these cycles. Daybreak prayer has 2. Noon prayer has 4. Afternoon, 4. Sunset, 3. And night prayer, 4. That's a total of 17 rak'ahs or cycles every 24 hours. The various movements and positions are accompanied then by special formulae. At the prayer's end, one utters the profession of faith while sitting, as well as a formula of blessing on the Prophet and on Muslim believers. The Salat, the ritual prayer, can be extended by reciting long parts of the Quran in the first 2 cycles. And besides the 5 required prayers, many, many more prayers are recommended throughout the day. Now, we'll get Doug to put up the first overhead there. When prayer time begins, the mu'adzin calls from the minaret of the mosque, or in some areas from its roof. So someone will stand up at the very top of the mosque and call the faithful to prayer. The call to prayer, the adhan, consists of the profession of faith and some additional short phrases, and it is sung in long cadences. Once the adhan is over, the believer then undertakes the ablution. He or she can perform the prayer in any clean place or else in the mosque with the community. But in both cases, absolute ritual purity is the first condition. After each minor pollution caused by solid, liquid or gaseous matters leaving the lower part of the body, as well as sleeping or fainting, the minor ablution, known as wudu, is required. The face, part of the head, the arms to the elbows, the feet to the ankles, have to be washed in running water that has not been touched by anyone. The details of the ablutions, elaborated exactly in the course of time, have to be observed minutely, from the intaking of water through the nostrils to the movement of the fingers when cleansing the ears. Each movement should be accompanied by a specific prayer formula. If none of the above-mentioned pollutions occurred between 2 prayer times, then one need not perform this particular ablution. After major pollutions, such as sex, menstruation and childbirth, a full bath, known as ghusl, is required, in which no place in the whole body, including the hair, can remain dry. Only then may the prayer be performed and the Quran touched and recited. It is a pious custom to perform ghusl before the communal prayer on Friday noon, even though no major pollutions exist. In the case where water cannot be found, a person can perform the ablution using sand. Let me summarise. Facing the right direction toward the Kaaba in Mecca, praying at the prescribed times, performing set ablutions, uttering the correct recitations, and adopting the distinguishing bodily positions are all a part of the requirements of prayer. These cannot be neglected, which is why Islamic manuals like this go into great detail regarding the correct way of performing ritual prayers and other religious duties. Now, this book that I have here, Know Your Islam by Yusuf N. Lalji, this whole book is pages like this, showing the Muslim how to correctly perform the movements of prayer, how to correctly wash themselves to perform the ablutions, what prayers to say during what cycle, during what time of the day, which words to utter in prayer. So it's quite detailed in a way that most of us perhaps are not used to. So that's the second pillar, Soat, or ritual prayer. Thanks, Doug. Flip that off for a moment. This brings us then to Zakat, almsgiving, or a charity tax. This is the third pillar. Charity towards man is laid down in the Quran as one of the great pillars on which the structure of Islam stands. Again and again and again, the Quran refers favourably to those who perform the ritual prayer and who provide alms, as both an act of worship to Allah and of service to the community. All adult Muslims who are able to do so are duty-bound to pay a wealth tax annually, levied against an individual's savings and investments, that is, their accumulated assets and not just their income, a tithe or percentage, typically 2.5%, is collected and distributed to the most deserving. According to the norms laid down within the Quran, we can see Surah 9, verse 60, the most deserving are, or the alms collected should be used to support the poor, orphans and widows, to free slaves and debtors, and to assist in the spread of Islam. As Muslim author Zayuddin Sardar notes, Zakat, often translated as poor due or charity, should not be mistaken for almsgiving out of one's own generosity. It is a duty and a social obligation. Stating this does not diminish the role of charity within Islam, but reminds us of the fact that the service of humanity and the amelioration of the poor and the needy is such an integral part of Islam that it is enjoined upon all Muslims. This brings us fourthly to Sawm, to fasting during Ramadan. Historically, the institution of fasting came after the institution of prayer. It is said that while in Medina and in the second year of the Hijra is referring to the Muslim calendar, that time where Muhammad left Mecca and went to Medina, so about 2 years of being in Medina, Muhammad made fasting obligatory, and the ninth month of the year, Ramadan, was set aside for this purpose. Since the Muslim calendar is lunar and not solar, a month only has about 28 or 29 days. This means that Ramadan comes about 10 days earlier each year. It also means that sometimes Ramadan is celebrated in the winter when the days are short, and sometimes in the summer where the days are long and hot. Ramadan can be particularly difficult for Muslims living in northern areas, where in the summer months there can be 18 to 20 hours of daylight. Now, the fast itself begins when the new moon is sighted and lasts right through until the sighting of the next new moon. Each day, from the first light of dawn in the morning until about half an hour after sunset in the evening, all adults must refrain from food, drink, sexual intercourse, and all actions that blemish righteousness. In recognition of the arduousness of this fast, people who are ill or who are travelling, and women in childbirth or who are menstruating are temporarily exempted, being allowed to compensate by making up the fast when they are able. Now, punctuating the rigour of this month-long fast is the relief that comes at dusk. With the day over, it becomes common for Muslim families to visit and share special meals together. In some Middle Eastern country, there are certain dishes and even candies that are made and shared around with family members only at this special time of year. It's a very festive time of year. But again, families come together to visit and share meals. Devout Muslims will go to the mosque for the evening prayer, followed by a special prayer called Taraweeh, recited only during the month of Ramadan. Other special acts of piety, such as the recitation of the entire Quran or Sufi chantings, may also take up evening hours. After a short evening sleep, families rise before sunset to take their first meal of the day, a meal that must sustain them right through until sunset. at the end of, as the end of Ramadan appears, normally on the 27th day, Muslims commemorate the Night of Power, when Muhammad first received revelation from Allah. The month then concludes with a great celebration, the Feast of Breaking Bread, known as Eid al-Fitr, understood as a time for reflection, for spiritual discipline, for expressing gratitude for God's guidance and atoning for past sins, as well as for cleansing the body and soul, and for understanding how the poor and needy feel. Yet one of Ramadan's key intentions is that of empowering the Muslim by developing the self-control so needed to gain entry to paradise. As the Muslim writer Saleh Mubarak states, rewards in life are earned, not given away. Heaven, the ultimate reward, must be earned with hard work, part of which is resisting temptation. We come to the fifth pillar, Hajj, the pilgrimage to Mecca. The fifth pillar of Islam is the pilgrimage or Hajj. Following Ramadan comes the pilgrimage season, during which every adult Muslim who is physically and financially able to must at least once in their lifetime perform the pilgrimage to Mecca. The focus of the pilgrimage is the Kaaba. Can you put the next one on for me too? The Kaaba is a cube-shaped structure in which a sacred black stone is embedded. Islamic tradition teaches that the Kaaba was originally built by Abraham and his son Ishmael, and that the black stone inside was given to Abraham by the angel Gabriel as a token of Allah's favour. Tradition states that the Kaaba was the object of pilgrimage even during pre-Islamic times, and that one of the first things the Prophet Muhammad did when he marched triumphantly into Mecca was to cleanse the Kaaba of tribal idols and restore it as a centre of true worship. As far as what is required, pilgrimage to a sacred place demands a ritual consecration. Thus, at a certain distance from Mecca, the men shave their heads. Sometimes they maybe cut just a tuft of hair as a symbol. Most shave their heads. They take off their ordinary clothing and put on a special white garment, the ihram, consisting of two unsewn pieces of cloth that cover their whole body. All around here, it's a bad photo, but these are actually individual Muslims in the ihram, in their white cloth around the Kaaba. Women may wear their simple national dress or put on a long white covering garment. Jewelry and perfume are both prohibited. When approaching Mecca, the pilgrims greet the sacred precincts with a call, "I am here, O Lord, I am here." Upon entering Mecca, the rites that then have to be performed for the Hajj to count as meritorious include the following. I might get you to put the next one up, Doug. Proceeding to the Grand Mosque, which is a picture here, where the Kaaba is located, and walking around the Kaaba in a counterclockwise circle 7 times, where one tries to kiss the black stone in the southeast corner. That's the first aspect of the Hajj or pilgrimage, to come to the central place, to walk around it 7 times, attempting to kiss the black stone embedded in the Kaaba. Then, running 7 times between 2 small hills, Safa and Marwa, in commemoration of Hagar's frantic search for water for her son. So all the elements of the pilgrimage are reenacting important Bible stories or important Quranic stories that are seen as central to Islamic faith and belief. And the 2 hills lie just a little bit outside, away from this central mosque. Then, standing on the hill Arafat, a distance of some 8 to 12 miles east from Mecca on the 9th day of the month, is essential to the Hajj. During this time of pilgrimage, pilgrims stand before Allah from noon to sunset in repentance, seeking forgiveness for themselves and for all Muslims worldwide. Doug, if you could put the next slide up. The pilgrimage ends with the Feast of Sacrifice, known as Eid al-Adha, which commemorates the day when Abraham was ordered to sacrifice his son Ishmael, whose place was then taken by a ram. This part of the ritual requires each pilgrim to slaughter a sheep or a larger animal, a large goat, sometimes even a camel. After this feast, the pilgrim can then return home. They can come out of what's known as a sacred state into their normal state when they're cutting of hair and nails, and one can engage in sex again. However, many pilgrims add to their pilgrimage a visit to the mosque and the tomb of Muhammad at Medina before returning to their homeland. Many Muslims who have made this pilgrimage will identify themselves as Haji, signifying that they have performed all that is required. This slide up here is a summary of what's required for this one pillar, this fifth pillar known as the Hajj. All of these various things must be performed for it to count as for if you have been on pilgrimage. If you come to to Mecca at a different time of the year, not during the month of Ramadan, and you do these things, it doesn't count. If you come to Mecca and don't perform all these things, even during the month of Ramadan, it doesn't count. All of these things must be performed in a particular order, at a particular time, in a set way. Thanks, Don. Now, if we had more time tonight, we would go on from here to talk about two often related areas. One, the concept of jihad, which means struggle, which although is often referred to as the sixth pillar of Islam, actually has no such official status. The other thing we should go on to talk about is Islamic family law, which is the complement to the five pillars and lies at the heart of a Muslim's duty to others. However, as I want to leave sufficient time for discussion tonight, let me just conclude as follows. Having now examined the central beliefs and practices of Islam, having considered something of what is actually required in upholding the pillars of faith and enacting the five pillars of Islam, I can honestly say that I, for one, am both challenged and amazed at the breadth and depth of Muslim piety and devotion. Unlike some others, I do not feel the need to question the sincerity of Muslims engaged in these exercises, nor can I fail to be impressed by the zealousness and ardent devotion of so many of the Muslims whom I know and see engaged in these things. However, when I recall the framework and the orientation of these pillars, and when I read quotations such as this one from the Muslim writer Muhammad Abdul Qasim, "The saving merit of the obligatory devotions accrues from their perfect performance, which of course is impossible in the case for most people." When I read quotations like that, I remember why I am a Christian. Let me close tonight not with the words of a theologian or apologist, but rather with the invitation of a hymn writer. "Come, ye sinners, poor and wretched, weak and wounded, sick and sore. Jesus stands ready to save you. Full of pity, joined with power, he is able, he is able, he is willing, doubt no more. Come, ye weary, heavy laden, bruised and broken by the fall. If you tarry till you're better, you will never come at all. Not the righteous, not the righteous, sinners Jesus came to call. Let not conscience make you linger, nor of fitness fondly dream." Listen to these words. "All the fitness he requires is to feel your need of him. This he gives you, this he gives you. 'Tis the Spirit's rising beam. Lo, the incarnate God ascended pleads the merit of his blood. Venture on him, venture wholly. Let no other trust intrude. None but Jesus can do helpless sinners good." The words of Joseph Hart. Any questions? Any discussion? The question is, when is the fast of Ramadan? It is in the ninth lunar month of the Muslim calendar. I think last year it was around November, but because it's a lunar calendar, not a solar calendar, it kind of floats around. But it's the ninth month of the Islamic calendar.
And it's for one day?
It's for the month. It's for the month of Ramadan. Between the hours of sunrise right through the day until half an hour after sunset. That entire period is kept as a fast. No food, no drink, no sexual relations, no smoking. It is kept completely as a fast. And most Muslims continue to work during the day and perform their duty, so it's quite arduous. The question is, what about the people in Alaska? Well, what happens is Islamic law, law known as a fiqh, it's a debate over what they should do. Some very devout, very pious Muslims would keep the fast for the entire duration of the sunlight hours, 20 hours, 22 hours. But Islamic law does allow for people in those extreme northern climes to actually take their clock from the nearest Muslim country at a lower elevation or a lower latitude, I guess. So, but there is some Muslims will not allow that, but the majority, I think, would. The question is, what do Muslims cite or quote as foretelling Muhammad's arrival? One of the things they, for example, from the Jewish scriptures from the Old Testament, Deuteronomy 18:18, is a prophecy of one coming. There'll be a prophet among you. And they say that prophet is Muhammad. Christians see that as a prophecy beyond Moses to Jesus. Muslims see that beyond even Jesus to Muhammad. In the New Testament, the passages in John 14 through 16 that talk about the paraclete or the advocate, the Holy Spirit who comes as the comforter, not believing in a Trinity, not believing in a Holy Spirit, that passage is read by Muslims as proclaiming and prophesying Muhammad the prophet. So Muslims will pick up our scriptures and point us to claims or attestations of Muhammad's coming from Jewish Christian scriptures. Now we might want to debate the legitimacy of that. I would, for one. But that is what Muslims believe and that is their practice. The whole question of the sinlessness of the prophets is very, very difficult. They would see that in part as our distortion. However, the strange thing is, the Quran itself records those same sins. So, for example, I wrote down here somewhere, I think Surah 107 is the main one. I should check that to make sure. Let me just do that quickly. Here we go. Surah 7, 11 to 27 records Adam's sin of eating the forbidden fruit. Surah 38, 18 to 25 records David's adultery. Surah 38, 31 to 36 records Solomon repenting after sin. Surah 38, 42 to 45 records Job's turning in repentance. Surah 37, 109 records Jonah's running away from God. Surah 47, 19 records Muhammad's own prayer for forgiveness of sin. And so I could go on. The only prophet who is not recorded as sinning is Jesus. However, Muslims affirm the sinlessness of all prophets. There's a huge question. The reason they can do that is because they have a very different view of what sin is. There's an equivocation over sin. In the Judeo-Christian tradition, sin is seen as a transgression or against God, as either missing the mark or straying into some area that's off limits. And our Bible tells us that the wages of sin is death. That all sin, if you like, is a capital offence in the eyes of God. We don't gradate sins. Islam does. Islam has minor sins and big sins. And big sin is basically shirk. That is idolatry or putting somebody up alongside Allah. So, for example, believing in the Godhead, being a polytheist directly, all those things are shirk. It's a big sin. You'll never get to paradise. The other things are little sins and can all be forgiven. They're inconsequential. And so when we point to the sins of the prophets, they say, yes, but it's not really that big a deal. But it's a very difficult claim. And I think it's one of the areas where I, as someone trying hard to understand Islam, keeps bumping up against what the Quran actually says and what is found in the history of Islamic theology. I think if we go back far enough, and I'm pretty sure in saying this, that very few Muslims in the very early period held to the sinlessness of the prophets. I've only ever found that talked about in contemporary apologists for Islam, of whom Maulana Muhammad Ali, who I quoted from, is one. I think what's happening, there's a particular school in Islam that plays up the sinlessness of all the prophets as a counter to the Christian elevation of Jesus as the one sinless man. So there's an apologetic maneuvering going on there.
Dick. You mentioned the unpardonable sin.
Yeah.
Is that the only one? What was that, and how does that fit in here? That was obviously, is there one heavy-duty sin and everything else is...
Seems to be. Yeah. It's very difficult because the language... Many of the Muslim... Let me put it this way, step back a few moments. In Christianity, theology is the queen of the sciences. Theology has an elevated place. In Islam, it's law, not theology. Law is the main focus, the mainstay of Islamic thinking, philosophy, practice. So there's a whole different trajectory going on there. So when it comes to this issue of unpardonable sin, it is stated theologically that it is shirk, the idea of idolatry or of associating any other god with Allah. But in other places, particularly in the jurists and the legal writers, certain sins are also regarded as discounting you from the Christian community. For example, many writers would actually claim that if any of these five pillars that we talked about are not performed correctly, then that puts somebody outside of being a Muslim. So, for example, if somebody does not perform the Hajj and all these things that we had on that graph, then they're an unbeliever. If somebody does not pray five times a day with 17 rakahs in the particular order facing Mecca, then they are now... So there's this slippage. There's this slippage in law. I went to some effort to point out the detail in each of these requirements, not because I wanted Islam to look bad, but because that is how Islam presents itself, and Islam is a religion of law. And all of these things are obligatory and have a very fixed form that it's important to keep. So theologically, shirk, idolatry, is the unpardonable sin, but in many Muslim communities, failing to keep up with certain of these practices can disqualify one from being a true Muslim or a believer. I'm going to give a lecture, possibly next term if I'm allowed, on jihad. Jihad is really... It's misunderstood, and I think it's misunderstood because it's very hard to get a hold of. It's a very slippery term. Jihad itself just simply means to struggle or to strive. And in Islam, jihad has basically two forms. Primarily, it has to do with what we as Christian people might think of as sanctification, that is, struggling to overcome personal sin. And so a Muslim enacts jihad on themselves. A Muslim strives to conform to the law and the rule of Allah. But of course, jihad has this second and much more famous application referred to as holy war. And so jihad is the application of the struggle to those outside of the Muslim community. Muslims typically defend jihad by saying that it is only ever a defensive action. So in the Quran, jihad is taught, but it is only when you're hard pressed or there's an outside force overshadowing or coming in on the Muslim community. History records that it has not just been used defensively, that there have been offensive uses of jihad, and we well know in this country various, you know, we think of the assassination of Anwar Sadat in Egypt by an Egyptian jihad group. We think of recent events that was known as jihad by certain fundamentalist Muslims. So it's a very slippery term. And it's complicated by the fact that you use the phrase peaceful Muslims. By definition, all Muslims are peaceful. Islam comes from the same root as the Hebrew shalom, peace. So Islam is a submitted one, one who's at peace with God. And so we talk about slippage in a whole new way there, where a Muslim assumes that they are at peace and they see jihad as bringing about peace. The broader submission to the will of Allah. Down the track I may get up enough courage to do a whole lecture on that. The difference between Sunni and Shiite Muslims goes back in history to the successors of Muhammad the Prophet. When Muhammad died, it appears he died, didn't die suddenly, but he obviously didn't expect to die because he made no preparations for his successor. And so various of his companions were elected after him. And certain groups of Muslims were, as this chain went along, were disappointed at one of the caliphs, one of the successors or rulers of the Muslim community. And they expected, and there was a division over who had the right to succeed Muhammad. And so a Shiite Muslim goes right back to very early on, late 7th century. And so there's a difference there in terms of the leadership succeeding Muhammad. And then again within that, some Shia Muslims believe that certain of the companions of the Prophet, certain of the later leaders, actually were sinless, like the prophets who delivered messengers of Allah. So they have a very exalted state. And some Shiites even believe that one, they're known as imams, one imam in particular will return at a later time. So Shias differ from the Sunnis in that way. And I think roughly the figure is something like 80% Sunni, 20% Shiite throughout the world. But that's their main theological difference. That's a great question. Is there a concept of the heart or of inner intent? There is, but it's just nowhere near as pronounced as what we're used to in Christianity or even in Judaism. It's very, very difficult to get to because so much of the literature focuses on the action. So there's not a lot of literature that I've come across that actually breaks down or explains an Islamic doctrine of motive in the way that, I mean, in Christian circles, as an example, we have tons of books dealing with what we would call heart issues, inner motivation. Islam, you just don't find that. You do to some degree in the mystic tradition, in Sufi Islam, another branch of Islam, but in the major branches of Islam, Sunni and Shiite, you really, really don't. And it gets complicated too, because when the Quran talks about the heart, when the Quran talks about motive, and when we talk about some of the things like goodness, kindness, sincerity, those kind of things are just used in such a different way. So I really am not qualified to give a definitive answer there, but just to say that there is something of it, but it just doesn't seem to have the place that I'm used to seeing in my own view of the world in Christianity. Modern Muslim apologists make a great emphasis on the love of God and on doing these five pillars with a full heart and altruistically. But in all that, but in the literature, that's never been a major emphasis at all. Muslims that I read have been very open about saying we do these things because it gets us here and it brings these benefits and these rewards. So I think that's about all that I can say there. I'm sorry, it's not a very good answer. That's a good question. How many Muslims actually perform all of these obligations? It's kind of like asking how long's a piece of string in one sense. We really don't know. The reality is that many do. But the reality also is that many do not. Friends of mine who've been career missionaries in the Sudan and in Yemen and Turkey and Pakistan have always said that, the percentage is probably less than a third. Now, that's very anecdotal. I wouldn't want to hold that up to any scientific scrutiny. But people that I know and respect who've lived amongst Muslims for 20 and 30 years have said that in their experience, few Muslims really practice all of the requirements and in the specific form that they're laid out. Certainly there are some
who do. Certainly there are groups that are very pious and very keen to work through all of these pillars in just the right way. But I think even in my own experience, where I lived in Melbourne and the Muslims that I knew, certainly most performed, prayed five times a day. Very few frequented Friday public prayer meetings. Most Muslims that I knew, I should be careful, a number of the Muslims that I know did not practice the ablutions, the washings, in the way that we saw on the screen here and I talked about, but still handled the Quran and went to mosque. I have never met a Muslim in a very small circle who's actually gone on the Hajj, the pilgrimage, yet. I know of other Muslims who've sent people in their place, paid for them to go so that they don't have to go. Now, so these are indications, just as in Christianity, that not everybody who claims this religious worldview, claims this practice, actually delivers. Percentage-wise, I have no idea what it is. The question is, what did I come across of purgatory? Islamic eschatology is fascinating at the moment, because just as there are certain trends within Christian circles, for example, in Christian circles there's huge debates over the nature and duration of the Christian doctrine of hell. Is it eternal? Is it conscious? Do we get annihilated? Whatever. Those same debates are happening right now in Islam. And just as in Christian circles, even in Protestant circles, purgatory is actually really making inroads. There's an article in the most recent edition of the magazine First Things, in which Jerry Walls, a professor of Asbury, talks about purgatory in Protestant framework. That all is also happening in Islamic circles. So you do find Muslims who talk about purgatory. And in fact, that goes back quite a way. Some Muslims, many Muslims, see hell not as being eternal, but as being a place in which people will be refined. So they don't use the language of purgatory, but the concept is very similar. The Roman Catholic doctrine of purgatory is that people go there and their sin or the dross of their life is burnt up. They pay their dues and then they're redeemed from that. In Muslim circles, hell functions in a similar way. That if you're not a Muslim, for example, you get chuffed off to hell. But some argue that Allah will ultimately bring everybody out. There's a universalistic streak in Islam. Others say that some Muslims will go to hell because their deeds weren't quite good enough. Perhaps they only performed 4 out of the 5 pillars, or there are Muslims who weigh up and evaluate these things. So there is a real strand of purgatory, but as it is within Christian circles, it's not agreed upon. It's not particularly defined, but it is talked about. Many Muslims today actually look at the doctrine of hell and just see it as some Christians would, as just being totally old-fashioned, taking these images far too literalistically, and what we're really talking about is cessation of being. And so all of these strands are current in Islamic eschatology. However, the majority view, or what would be termed a classical view, is that there is a real eternal hellfire and a real eternal paradise. The question of seeking converts by force is also difficult. Most Muslims, all Muslims, would say, yes, it's wrong. The Quran emphatically teaches that we're not to bring people into Islam by force. So it's quite emphatic in the Quran, and many contemporary Muslim scholars are at pains to go back and say, look, this is what the Quran says. And many Muslim apologists go to great length to show that it's never happened in history. And yet history records that there have been times where converts have been taken in by force. I don't think it's happened as many times as some Christians or Western scholars assume. I think sometimes it's very hard to see through expansion from a religious angle, proselytizing, and expansion politically. In Islam, those things are bound together, but not always exactly the same thing. But there are certainly cases, particularly in the early centuries, of various groups, various Muslim communities, taking the children of Christians who live under Muslim rule away by force to be trained in a mosque. And those children are removed from their parents, from their family scene, and from very early age are trained in Arabic and reading the Quran. They learn to recite the Quran. And then they are then, after quite a number of years, after an apprenticeship really, are put into the very upper echelon of Islamic society. So very few ever turn back. There is documented evidence of that, and Muslim scholars themselves talk about that. But again, they would not see that as proselytizing. They have another term or understanding for that. But it has gone on. So that in history there have been occasions where people have been forced to make profession by the sword. But again, I don't think as often as Western scholars are quick to believe. Most Muslims are interested in talking about their religion. Most Muslims understand that a blessing from Allah resides on those who invite others into the faith. The Quran has quite a bit to say about talking to other people, particularly Jews and Christians, about Islam. For those who may not have heard over this side, the question has to do with what about those who attempt to do all of these things but can't make it because they're so demanding? Are there ways you can make up? In Islamic law, there's a division between what's obligatory and what's above and beyond that, what you can do beyond what's enshrined in law. And both are meritorious. So, for example, I hinted at it, if you cannot go on the Hajj because of illness or financial impoverishment or because you're travelling, you can do it at a later date. If you cannot undergo the fasting in the month of Ramadan, in the case of a woman, if you're pregnant or menstruating or something like that, you must make it up at a later time and you perform the same ritual obligations. And there are all kinds of other prayers. And this little book here by Yusuf N. Lalji, there's a whole list of prayers that are broken down into what you must say and what you can say and what is helpful to say and good to say. Prayers at funerals, prayers after meals, prayers at weddings, prayers when travelling, and so on. So there really is a system of meriting things above and beyond. However, it's very difficult to know what to make of that, because passages in the Quran talk about the grace of Allah being that even after the books have been opened, the scales weighed, there's a passage that talks about Allah just simply emptying out, picking out people from hell and bringing them into paradise anyway. It seems that there will be some people who've not been Muslim, who've not done these things, that will end up in paradise as an expression of grace or mercy of Allah. So it's a very, very different system to what we're used to. Because Allah is not like Jehovah God, he's not bound to a covenant, he's not announced beforehand what ought to be done on our side and what he will do on his side, Allah is able to move and to act. And so as a consequence, no Muslim, no matter how sincere they are, no matter how much they strive to do all these things, no Muslim has a guarantee of reaching paradise. And even Muhammad in the Hadith says that he doesn't know. He'll wait for Allah. So it's very difficult to put all the pieces together. Yeah, the children growing up in Muslim homes need to make an individual decision. Yeah. They do, but of course it's enforced on them in a way that's very different in Christianity, and the decision is much simpler. It's simply the profession or the shahada, acknowledging that Allah is one and Muhammad is his prophet. And so it tends to come at quite a young age, and it's many Muslims, not all many Muslims, who are brought up in an active Muslim home really don't know a time when they weren't a professing Muslim. Because from a very young age, they're taught the prayers and the cycles of prayer, all of which are based around that very profession. So it's not quite—it's not the same as in a Christian home. Yeah, but it's a good question, though.